This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. On February 15th of 2014, the Santa Cruz poet Robert Sword came up to Sonoma County to read at the Word Temple Poetry Series. It is always wonderful to hear Robert Sword read. He was celebrating his collection, New and Selected Poems, 1957 to 2011. There are a couple of excellent, what we call blurbs on the back of this book that really give you a good idea of what Robert Sword's work is about and what it does. The poet and critic Jack Foley says, "Robert Sword's poems are the result of a plunge into a never fully ironized, often hilarious sense of mysticism. They are the product of a restless, spiritually adventuresome sensibility masking itself as a stand-up comedian." This poet learned early that the comic, the zany, was a mask by which one could assert oneself, through which one would be listened to. In his poems, the mask remains, but it is at the service of an essentially visionary impulse, the vision, the life that it requires. Wonderful work. And Ellen Bass wrote, "These are such funny, sad, generous poems, peopled with characters it's impossible not to love, especially Robert's podiatrist Jewish Rosicrucian father, with his wisdom that bridges all dualities, expounding on the feet and the soul, sex and death, the broken and the whole." In one poem, Robert asserts, "In a world of no, dogs are a yes. And in the world of poetry, this book is a resounding yes. Read it when you're happy, but especially read it when you're depressed. You'll find yourself joining in with the many dogs in these poems saying, woof, woof, effin' woof." That was Ellen Bass. So here now is Robert Sword reading from his new and selected poems.
I just want to thank you all for coming out, leaving Santa Cruz earlier, rainy day, and you know, I like reading on Valentine's Day, but somehow that in between days, and then President's Day coming up on Monday, I'm delighted and really was very pleased that you all turned out, and for Catherine for inviting me and encouraging me. Ram Dass says, "Old age is about harvesting whatever your life's work has been. Now in my 80s, I don't feel especially old, but my life's work has been and continues to be poetry. And 50 years later, after my first publication, this is harvest time," which is how I see this volume. I'm going to start with the canines. A poem called In a World of No. Franz Kafka says, "All that I cared for was the race of dogs, and that and nothing else. To whom but dogs can one appeal in the wide and empty world?" In a world of no, and by the way, I have the dog is a speaker in many of the dog poems. I worked as a newspaperman for some time in Canada, and did a lot of interviews, and doing these interviews and features about people, I learned to listen. I mean, in a way that I hadn't done before, and somehow it's covered my work. So in my case, journalism has been a positive thing. In a world of no, dogs are a yes. 68 million dogs in America, and they understand there's a fundamental human reaction to everything, and it's no, no. Dogs hate hearing like that. People, it's all no, and no, and no. They look at a dog sometimes, and the dog is on his back, say, on someone's lawn, legs in the air, rolling and bouncing. "This is a hand I was dealt. I'm a dog," says the dog. "It's not a problem. But people, look at me. I don't have time for this," you're thinking. "Something better is going to come later." No, no, it won't. As Ram Dass says, this is all there is. This is all you get. All knowledge, the totality of all questions and answers, is contained in the dog. Do you know who said that? Kafka. That's right, Kafka. Bow wow, bow wow, bow wow now. Let's see. So this is The World According to Shelby. It's sort of a sad weekend because Shelby is actually a dog that belongs to my daughter. And for maybe 14 or 15 years, this dog has been her constant companion. And the dog became senile and would go into corners and not know how to get back out. And just age. And so she's putting the dog down. And I'm just really moved and really, I need to make contact with her, which I will do tomorrow. Anyway, the world according to Shelby. And so her dog is the muse for a number of these pieces. So the dog says, the world is going to the dogs, and I'm the dog the world is going to. Shelby here, S-H-E-L-B-Y. Lift your leg. What? You want my resume? Sniff here. Ruff, ruff. If I can smell your ass, I know what you got up your sleeve. Now shut up. Shut up and let me bark. For starters, food has a way of anchoring thought, I'll tell you that. The stomach and the heart, they're the same thing. But I want to know, after 10,000 years of domestication, what does it mean to be a dog anymore? Of course, it's true. 90% of our genetic makeup is the same as yours. I read shit like that. You need what you think I need? Need what, an interspecies relationship? Give me a bow. Give me a wow. Give me a bow wow wow. Remember, your woof woof is connected to your bow wow. Be cool. Love like war. Winner is who stays longer. You know, sometimes it's just good to hang out with your own kind. This is a 10-line poem, again, in the canine domain. It's called Companion Animals. And Companion Animals, it's interesting. I mean, this interspecies relationship, you know, that one can... One seems to have. I mean, I have an interspecies relationship with our little poodle. How do we describe these creatures that we interact with? And they are companions, more than companions. I mean, they're like, you know, children. This is called the purpose of dogs. Charles Darwin says, the difference in mind between man and the higher animals, great as it is, certainly is one of degree and not of kind. And again, the dog is speaking. 90% of our genetic makeup is the same as yours. But you, my friend, 22 feet from your mouth to your anus. It's all right, boss. Dogs understand. They know what it means to be human. Still, the doctor who said the purpose of dogs is to stimulate the subcortical reward system, that doctor needs a doctor. Woof. Woof and woof. The purpose of dogs is for you to... The purpose of dogs is for you to walk around after us with a little bag. This is a transition. I'm looking forward to talking more with Mark and with his wife Lisa. And one thing, we have a number of things in common, one of which is we both were at the University of Iowa in that writer's workshop. I was there, we just missed one. I was there as a student, and then I went back there to teach, but this was before Mark was there. I'd been in the Navy for a couple of years, went to the University of Illinois on a GI Bill, found myself at Iowa in the poetry workshop, and you know, my background is just very, you know, middle class, Chicago, Jewish neighborhood. Just, you know, with a father who said, you know, you're smart, you go to college and be a lawyer, you know, all that. And so here I am at Iowa for some reason, and I write this poem, Iowa. What a strange happiness. 60 poets have gone off drunken, weeping into the hills, I among them. There's no one of us who is not a fool. What is to be found there? What is the point in this? Someone scrawls 6 lines and says them. What a strange happiness. And so when they had the 75th Iowa Writers' Workshop anniversary, they somehow chose that poem, surprised me, and made copies of it and, you know, circulated it. But it was just that sense of wonderment.
Wasn't that in the Miller and Williams anthology?
Yeah, that's right.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks, Mark. This is called Ode to Torpor. And Garrison Keillor read this thing on the radio, and I can't begin to approximate it. He's a good reader, But I'll do what I can. Ode to Torpor. Glory be to God for the tiresome and tedious. Glory be to God for the tedium, for no news about anything, for newspaper strikes and power outages, lethargy and downtime, postpone and delay, and again, postpone and delay. No place to go, no way to get there, no reason not to stay. Glory be to God for inaction, for not getting things done, for not getting anything done. No huffing, no puffing, just some of that slow and easy. The woman lackadaisically on top, the man lackadaisically on top. Yummy, yummy, take your time. Yummy, yummy, I'll take mine. Slow and easy, slow and easy. Glory be to God, oh glory be to God. A Valentine's Day love poem. So I've worked many years as an academic, and this is a piece called Postmodern. It's a mostly found poem. I enjoy Mark's found poems as well. So what happened is the husband comes home and he's grading his papers, and he's reading aloud, you know, some of the errors or the problems or things that strike him about the papers. So a lot of this just comes from the student work. Joan of Arc was married to the biblical Noah. The inhabitants of Egypt were called mummies and built pyramids in the shape of triangular cubes. The pyramids are a range of mountains between France and Switzerland. He graded his papers and went home to honey. Areas of the desert are cultivated by irritation. Honey and the teacher were newlyweds. Filing in her nails, she watched some Joan Crawford movie, handed him a joint. Get your papers graded, applying nail polish. Honey reached for Cosmopolitan and turned back to the TV guide. All pink and red she was, and full of self-esteem and bounce, the teacher's fluorescent bride. Now or never, honey said, her eyes twinkling. Post-civilization, post-modern, post-crackerjack, early unforeseeable, post-paradigm. Now you see it, now you don't. They lived in the Sahara Desert and traveled by Camelot. In the desert, the climate is such the inhabitants have to live elsewhere. So I don't know. I've taught a lot of creative writing classes, but these are pretty original. So my daughter Hannah was born when we were living in Canada, which I did for 15 years. And one day we took a train ride from Vancouver to Montreal. And so we're in this little compartment. She's having breakfast and she gets some jam in a bit between her two eyes. Her third eye is strawberry jam, has a little iris in it. Her eyelids are red. She's sleepy. And the milk has gone down the wrong way. I've just had breakfast with the smallest person in the world. And remind me of your names again. We were talking before the.
Brand.
Yeah. She met her partner at Bredlow School of English when we were both there in the same class studying with William Meredith. And this was 1957, so tonight's the first time we've seen one another in that, and it's just a really warm. I don't know. I feel like a real connection somehow. This is called "God Is in the Cracks," which is the title of this book. Yeah, this is "God Is in the Cracks," and the title comes from a poem by Leonard Cohen. You know, well, "God Is in the Cracks." There's something about that's how the light gets in. And my dad, as Catherine mentioned, was a podiatrist, Jewish podiatrist, who became a Rosicrucian later in his life. And I would go to him as a patient, because, you know, there's always something wrong with my feet, which I never quite understood. So he needed to work on them, and he needed to share his philosophy, his way of looking at things. And he was born something a little over 100 years ago in Russia. And so I'm first generation, I realize. So Dad says, just a tiny crack separates this world from the next. And you step over it every day. God is in the cracks. Foot propped up, nurse hovering, phone ringing. Relax and breathe from your heels. Now that's breathing. So tell me, have you enrolled yet? Enrolled? In the Illinois College of Podiatry. Dad, I have a job. I teach. Ha! Well, I'm a man of the lower extremities. Dad, I'm 43. So what? I'm 80. I knew you before you began wearing shoes. Too good for feet, he asked. I, me, mind. That's all I get from your poetry. Your words lack feet. Forget the mind. Mind is all over the place. There's no support. You want me to be proud of you? Be a footman. Here, son, he says, handing me back my shoes. Try walking in these. Arch supports. Now there's a subject. Someday you're right about arch supports. I read a couple more poems. This is called Fashion Makes the Heart Grow Fonder. And Robert Burton has a book called Anatomy of Melancholy, where he says, marriage and hanging go by destiny. Partygoers. It's a night for the muses, I suppose, because this is a muse situation. Her fruity floral fragrance, honey at her dressing table, like a pilot in the cockpit, a woman in control, old TV guides, catalogs, ordering information for all the major potions and scents. She put on, how can I describe them? Refrigerator, avocado, green and white, Keith Partridge, bell bottoms, bizarre and incandescent. No less bizarre, I wore purple velveteen pants and a tie-dye shirt. Her old lover Warren was there in his pimp suit, giant bug-eye sunglasses, and a huge fake fur pimp hat. A party with vintage Joan Crawford movies. Honey wearing Chanel No. 5, the first synthetic scent. And me, her consort, I wore a blend of crisp citrus and warm spice, mossy woods, a scent for the feeling man. I remember her silver and turquoise earrings and makeup table as the bed jumped and jerked those first 2 years. Ravi Shankar, Thai weed and a little homegrown, that velvet ribbon choker with butterflies and the scent of her as she, oh, yummy, yummy, oh, yes, yes, yummy, honey's tooled leather belt on the floor. Then, tell me what you want, I said. You can't give me what I want. What do you want? I'm out of style and so are you. I want to lose weight. And like that, it was over. How about this handbag, offered Cosmo? The perfect accessory to the outfit you wear when you leave your husband. And that's how it ended. Honey, at some fashion show, throwing back her head, the spotlight playing on her face and neck. Yes, I could see what Honey wanted. To shop where she'd never shopped before. To pull on high leather boots and a miniskirt. Then bearded Navajo handbag in hand, flashing a little scented thigh, walking out on someone who couldn't keep up, a jerk in tie-dye. I loved the woman, longed to stay with her, and to do so, if I could have arm in arm with her, I would have walked out of myself. This is for Gloria on her 60th birthday, some years ago, or looking for love in Merriam-Webster. So one of the places I go when I'm wanting to write is the dictionary. I mean, just looking up words like the, and so I'm wanting to write a poem for my wife, and I look, first for her name is Gloria. Beautiful, splendid, magnificent, delightful, charming, appealing, says the dictionary. And that's how I start. But I hear her say, make it less glorious and more Gloria. Imperious, composed, skeptical, serene, lustrous, irreverent, she's marked by glory. She attracts glory. Glory, I say, glory, glory. Is there a hallelujah in there, she asks when I read her lines 1 and 2. Not yet, I say, looking up from my books. She protests, writing a poem isn't the same as really attending to me. But it's for your birthday, I say, pouting, plainfully cross. That's the price you pay when your love's a poet. She has chestnut-colored hair, old-fashioned clairbeau lips, moist brown eyes, arms outstretched, head thrown back. She glides toward me and into her 7th decade. Her name means to adore, to rejoice, to be jubilant, to magnify and honor as in worship, to give or ascribe glory. My love, oh Gloria, I do, I do. And then I want to finish with another poem, in a sense, about teaching. It's a poem called Turning 60. So it's, what do you do as an English teacher, you know, when you're turning 60? These ages, going from 29 to 30 is one thing, 39 to 40 is something else, 49 to 50 is something else, 59 to 60, 69 to 70, I had trouble with 70, and that was the worst so far. And turning 80, I mean, we had a big party. I think it helps to really have a really big party. To get over, even to have a small, intimate evening with friends. So, turning 60. The first 40 years of life give us the text. The next 30 supply the commentary on it. That's from Schopenhauer. So, it's just just 2 sections I want to read. It's fairly short. First section is called Grammar as Hymnal. Seeking solace in a review of grammar, I turn to Strunk and White's Elements of Style. Standing at attention, opening to the section on usage, I chanted and sang, uniting my voice with the voices of others, the vast chorus of the lovers of English. We sing of verb tense, past, present, and future. We sing the harmony of simple tenses. We lift our voice in praise of action words and the function of verb tense. We sing of grammar, which is our compass, providing as it does clues as to how we might navigate the future. At the same time, it illuminates the past. As a teacher, I talk. That's present. For 30 years as a teacher, I talked. That's past. It may only be part-time, but I will talk. That's future. And then the last section is about 8 or 9 lines, called Living the Future Perfect. I will have invoke the muse. I will have remembered to give thanks, knowing our origins are in the invisible, and that we once possessed boundless energy, but were formless, and that we are here to know the things of the heart through touching. I will have remembered, too, that there is only one thing we all possess equally, and that is our loneliness. I will have loved, you will have loved, we will have loved. Thank you.
This is Catherine Hastings. You have been listening to Robert Sword reading from his collection, New and Selected Poems, 1957 to 2011. This book was published by Red Hen Press. During his reading, he mentioned Mark a few times and spoke with him. That was Mark Irwin, who also read that night. I aired a show with him last year. Okay, before moving on, I want to remind people in Sonoma County about the Digging Our Poetic Roots Project. If you have not yet signed up to participate in this project, you can send me a note at submissions@wordtemple.com, and I'll send you all the information you need to know to write some poems and possibly get published in an anthology of Sonoma County poets. So that's submissions@wordtemple.com. All right, we just sped right past Mother's Day, and before we go on to our next poet, Roy Mash, I'm going to play a recording of the great Robert Duncan reading his poem, My Mother Would Be a Falconress.
From Bending the Bow, I'm going to read My Mother Would Be a Falconress. My mother would be a falconress, and I, her gay falcon treading her wrist, would fly to bring back from the blue of the sky to her bleeding a prize, where I'd dream in my little hood with many bells jangling when I'd turn my head. My mother would be a falconress, and she sends me as far as her will goes. She lets me ride to the end of her curb, where I fall back in anguish. I dread that she will cast me away, for I fall, I mistake, I fail in her mission. She would bring down the little birds, and I would bring down the little birds. When will she let me bring down the little birds, pierced from their flight with their necks broken, their heads like flowers limp from the stems? I tread my mother's wrist and would draw blood. Behind the little hood, my eyes are hooded. I have gone back into my hooded silence, talking to myself and dropping off to sleep. For she has muffled my dreams in the hood she has made me, sewn round with bells, jangling when I move. She rides with a little falcon upon her wrist. She uses a barb that brings me to cower. She sends me abroad to try my wings, and I come back to her. I would bring down the little birds to her. I may not tear into. I must bring back perfectly. I tear at her wrist with my beak to draw blood, and her eye holds me, anguish terrifying. She draws a limit to my flight, never beyond my sight, she says. She trains me to fetch and to limit myself in fetching. She rewards me with meat for my dinner, but I must never eat what she sends me to bring her. Yet it would have been beautiful if she would have carried me always in a little hood with bells ringing at her wrist, and her riding to the great falcon hunt, and me flying up to the curb of my heart from her heart to bring down the skylark from the blue to her feet, straining and then released for the flight. My mother would be a falconress, and I heard your falcon raised at her will from her wrist, sent flying as if I were her own pride, as if her pride knew no limits, as if her mind sought at me flight beyond the horizon. Ah, but high, high in the air I flew, and far, far beyond the curb of her will were the blue hills of the falcon's nest. And then I saw west to the dying sun. It seemed my human soul went down in flames. I tore at her wrist, at the hold she had for me, until the blood ran hot, and I heard her cry out, far, far beyond the curb of her will, to horizons of stars beyond the ringing hills of the world where the falcon's nest I saw, and I tore at her wrist with my savage beak. I flew as if sight flew from the anguish in her eye beyond her sight, sent from my striking loose from the cruel strike at her wrist, striking out from the blood to be free of her. My mother would be a falconress, and even now, years after this, when the wounds I left her had surely healed and the woman is dead, her fierce eyes closed, and if her heart were broken, it is still. I would be a falcon and go free. I tread her wrist and wear the hood, talking to myself, and would draw blood.
That was Robert Duncan. All right. In March of 2014, the Marin County poet Roy Mash read at the Word Temple Poetry Series along with Clive Mattson and Susan Cohen. I will be airing Clive and Susan at another time, but I'm going to air Roy Mash right now. He is the author of Buyer's Remorse, a celebration of the small, the overlooked, and the underrated. He draws on themes of the body, of mathematics, and rationality, and much more. Mash calls forth everyone from Archimedes to Tweety Bird in this collection. It's a really fun book. Charles Harper Webb sees Buyer's Remorse as a, quote, celebration of the non-epic and unheroic, the bad decision, the cannonball we do to spite the backflip that eludes us, the inglorious lives we seem to have wound up with by mistake. Called an incorrigible wag who's smuggled his pea shooter into the church of poetry, Mash, a longtime board member of the Marin Poetry Center, gave us a really entertaining evening. So here now is Roy Mash reading at the Word Temple Poetry Series. You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM.
I want to say how pleased I am to be here. I've been salivating about reading at the Word Temple for quite some time, and finally here. I want to begin with a poem not by me. I'd like to at least include one poem in my readings, not hyphen by hyphen me. So here's a poem called I Like My Own Poems by Jack Grapes. I like my own poems best. I quote from them from time to time, saying, a poet once said, and then follow up with a line or two from one of my own poems appropriate to the event. How those lines sing. All that wisdom and beauty. Why, it tickles my ass off its spine. Why, those lines are mine, I say. And Jesus, what a bang I get out of it. I like the ideas in them, my poems. Ideas that hit home. They speak to me. I mean, I understand what the hell the damn poet's talking about. Why, I've been there. The same thing, I shout. And Christ, what a shot it is. A shot. And hey, the words. Whew. I can hardly stand it. Words sure do not fail this guy, I say. From some world only he knows. He bangs the bomb, but I can feel it in the wood of the word, rising to its form in the world. Now you gotta be good to do that, I say. And damn, it just shakes my heart, you know? That's by Jack Grapes. Just discovered him. And so I thought I'd follow up with a poem of my own. I think it's the only one that's not in the book that I'll do tonight. It's somewhat in the same thing. It's called A Great Artist. I could be a great artist if only what other people thought didn't count. Or counted. But in a different way. For instance, I have this fantasy where I'm stalked by spirits so tone deaf. I am to them like Frank Sinatra is to me. They crowd around my shower to get an earful. Inside the sound of the water, the surging of their cheers cannot be quashed. Encore follows encore. Finally, letting the mic fall to my waist, I step out humbly and towel off to eternal applause. A great artist. Okay, so some memories really last through a lifetime, and I like to mine these memories that have really stuck with me from boyhood. This is one of those poems. It's called The Worst Way to Go. Now, as far as I know, no girl I've ever known had ever played that game, and every boy I ever knew played the game. So this is the, and you can tell me afterwards. Please, women, if you ever did this. The worst way to go. A perennial boyhood debate. Of course, it wasn't any good if you didn't imagine it happening to you. Burned alive. Buried alive. Eaten alive. It was important to put in the part about being alive. Hanging, drawing, and quartering didn't seem so bad until someone explained the details. Then there was quicksand, forced to breathe in goop in the dark alone. Companions standing around the smooth surface, alive. In Tarzan, they would string upside down some poor native sap, never closely identified, to the tips of two tall trees bent to the ground for the purpose of making a wishbone of him. It was pretty quick, and you would think, not so bad. The screen came off camera. Still, it could give you the willies. For the rules said it had to be you strapped up there. You spraddled. You wriggling. You waiting for the snap. On to another childhood type of memory. This is called, do I have a little poster to go with this? No, it's in my bag. In any case, it's called Love of Slapstick. Come, spritz of seltzer in the face. Implacable banana peel. Come, brickbats, pratfalls, amazing grace, listness, the yowl of the schlemiel. Away with wit, you clever flights of phrase, it takes a PhD to explicate. One good food fight's worth 50 Oscar Wilde's to me. A can of paint on Keaton's head, another on his foot. What bliss! God bless the doofuses who spread the net he manages to miss. Come, whoopee cushions, slamming doors. Come, bops and jabs and spit takes sprayed on brides by grooms with falling drawers. Oh, heaven of the seventh grade. No sadism this, no black desire. Just Larry Moe and Curly's woes, the thousand gouges that conspire to make the milk come out my nose. Come, O pie-faced, and my feet glued to the floor, my tie caught in the gears, the audience in stitches, who can't help but laugh themselves to tears. Next up is a love poem of a different sort. I suppose you could call Love of Slapstick a love poem. This is called Whenever I See Her, and it comes with an epigraph from Theodore Retke. This is from a poem of Retke's called The Swan. And the epigraph goes like this. I am my father's son. I am John Donne whenever I see her with nothing on. Whenever I see her. Whenever I see her with nothing on, John Donne is just about the last person anyone would be inclined to compare me with. My father, not least. To be sure, I have my metaphysical moments, like everyone else. But she unpantsed. The history of ideas recedes to airy thinness. The history, several decades of marriage, notwithstanding. When I catch a peek of her, I half suspect a glitch in the universe. So unnatural it seems, so anomalously surreal, as though my eyes were 17 again. brimmed with all the guilty vistas heaven obscures. In the movies, when the camera lingers on the sequence of socks and bra, slacks and blouse and tie, discreetly stopping at the bed's edge, we discover peeping is denied to us. So when now, hurrah, I finally get to pan the camera up, it's like I am riding a jet ski with her and my father and Ted Retke. Let's see. I've worn glasses pretty much since I was 9 years old and finally got around to thinking about them. Here's a poem called Glasses, of which I can demonstrate right here. All day they've ridden me along the trails of the city, down one gully and up another, digging their heels into the sides of my nose, patting my plodding head, and whispering encouragement into my ears. Now, dismounted onto the nightstand, folded back into their old lotus position, they've let the moonlight pass through them. It's two pools of silver, while I graze nearby, unsaddled in the fuzzy tumbleweed. They know I will not wander far. Another scene of domesticity here, a poem called Making the Bed. I actually do make the bed sometimes. There's a moment after the sheet's been snapped, cast into a bosomy sky, before it lapses in a shambles at your knees. When it seems as if it's going to amble perfectly, consolingly down, like a hand on a troubled shoulder, a fatherly hand that grows gentler, featherier with nearness, promising falsely everything's okay. Everything. Okay. And now, let's see, I think I'll switch gears to that cannonball poem that Charles mentioned. Another boy poem, but I guess girls did cannonballs too. Cannonball. It was a great pow of a dive, made for boys who specialized in feats of little skill and spectacular effect. Impudent competition for the god-shaped swan, all breast and feather and grace. The jackknife that released itself to slit the water like a lover's hand slipping into an open robe. What was elegance but a thing to be expunged, undone by the effrontery of a great fat splurge, the gaudy broadside of an eclair shrapneling the cheeks of chubby summer, Goodbye, cruel world. The wrecking ball of the body symbol crashed into the smug surface. Depth charge churning in a blue fury of bubbles. Cool nucleus of boy sizzling in the silent below. Was ever anything more splendiferous than the sheer stupid pleasure of making a mess? To geyser up like truth, starshot across a world smithereened with watery rubble and the shrieks of poolside girls dismayed by the brash, flamboyant, uncontainable kaboom of you, you, you. And I'm going to finish up with a poem called Index. I have a number of poems dedicated to fingers. And fingers, for me, they serve a few purposes. They're like aspects of my personality, like a little family. You've got the father and the firstborn son, and the wife is over here. Here's the shy daughter. This is the kind of runt of the litter. I've got one called Thumb also. And I think of them sometimes on the as like movie stars. So this would be Gregory Peck. This would be Paul Newman, Edward G. Robinson, Laura from Glass Menagerie. So isn't that... Let's see. Now I just have time to do the one. So I will do just Index, the Paul Newman one. And this will be the last poem. This is I, is you, the one, the only, firstborn, numero uno, identity. That, of course, is they, the many, the rest, cast and chorus to this triumphant, starring solo. Supreme, it sweeps its wand of name over the world and its lists. Like any hero, it knows no ambiguity, no shy yearning, no subterranean shame. Not like that disgruntled schlub grumbling off to the side. Not like that crybaby at the other end, sniffing back the tears of a scraped knuckle. Nor that dad lording it over, nor that clinging mom balancing the tableau. Rather, we have this rugged digit of choice. The one you hold forth with. The one that commands attention. The one you count on when you finally decide to push the button. Flip the switch. Squeeze the trigger. Starting quarterback, squadron leader, peninsula of sanity above the dribbling, wriggling mob. Mast that holds together the rigging of your life. Sturdy, certain axis. Protagonist, you, Hancho. Integrity's own Jacques. Everyone knows the gun in the trench coat pocket trick. But think, what other would you trust to gauge the wind or wag a warning? scour frosting, or trace a heart in the sand, beckon a lover, or touch your nose to show you're sober, traverse a list, or pull out your cheek to make a pop. Who else would you have keep your place in a book or point the way out of the jungle of things in which you are forever getting lost? Thanks so much.
You've been listening to Marin County poet Roy Mash reading from his first full-length collection of poetry, Buyer's Remorse. We have some time left in tonight's program, and since it's been an all-male lineup so far with the great Robert Sword and Roy Mash, I'm going to play a number of poems by women poets. I will tell you who they are at the end. See if you recognize them, though, as we go on. Here we go.
This first love poem, called When You Have Forgotten Sunday, The Love Story, is a testimony to the youth of my marriage. I was 21 when I met my husband-to-be, who was also 21. I belonged to the NACP Youth Council at that time, and a mutual friend of ours had told him, you ought to go to one of those meetings because there's a girl there who writes poetry. In those long ago times, there was not a lot of stress on creativity. So if you heard of somebody in town who wrote poetry and you wrote poetry, as did my husband to be, you'd go quite a distance to meet same. So one evening I looked up, and there framed in the doorway was my husband-to-be, looking elegant, erect, with his hands behind him as he looked around with a sophisticated glance that took in everything. Handsome, I thought, and he thought. And I said to another friend that I was sitting with, Margaret, look, there's the man I'm going to marry. And she said, hey, boy, this girl wants to meet you. That's the way we met. And a month and a week later, we were engaged. And a year and a month and a week later, we were wed. So what does that say to you young girls out here who want a similar result? Start writing poetry, obviously. However, you don't have to get married, girls, if you don't want to. These are new times, and there's a lot out there for you, even if you don't get married. But if you do meet somebody who's just right, go ahead and take a chance. And when you have forgotten the bright bedclothes on a Wednesday and a Saturday, and most especially when you have forgotten Sunday, when you have forgotten Sunday halves in bed, or me sitting on the front room radiator in the limping afternoon, looking off down the long street to nowhere, hugged by my plain old wrapper of no expectation and nothing I have to do, and I'm happy, why? And if Monday never had to come, when you have forgotten that, I say, and how you swore if somebody beeped the bell, and how my heart played hopscotch if the telephone rang, and how we finally went into Sunday dinner, that is to say, went across the front room floor to the ink-spotted table in the southwest corner to Sunday dinner, which was always chicken and noodles or chicken and rice and salad and rye bread and tea and chocolate chip cookies. I say, when you have forgotten that, when you have forgotten my little presentiment that the war would be over before they got to you, and how we finally undressed and whipped out the light and flowed into bed and lay loose-limbed for a moment in the weekend bright bedclothes, then gently folded into each other. When you have, I say, forgotten all that, then you may tell. Then I may believe you have forgotten me well.
This one is called Her Sadness. When days are short, mountains already white-headed, the west red in its branchy leaflessness, I know more than a simple sow should know. I know the days of a pig and the days of dog brothers, cat pigs, cud-chewing cow friends are numbered. Even the days of Sylvia the pet, even the days of humans are numbered. Already laps are denied me. I cannot be cuddled. They scratch my ears as if I were any pig fattening for bacon. I shall grow heavier still, even though I walk for miles with my humans through field and forest. Mortality weighs on my shoulders. I know too much about time for a pig.
One perfect rose. A single flower he sent me since we met. All tenderly his messenger he chose. Deep-hearted, pure, with scented dew still wet. One perfect rose. I knew the language of the floweret. My fragile leaves, it said, his heart enclose. Love long has taken for his amulet. One perfect rose. Why is it no one ever sent me yet one perfect limousine, do you suppose? Ah, no, it's always just my luck to get one perfect rose.
This is Catherine Hastings. You just heard three poets. Gwendolyn Brooks reading When You Have Forgotten the Love Story, Denise Levertov reading Her Sadness, and of course, everyone knows that was Dorothy Parker reading her poem, One Perfect Rose. I want to thank my guest tonight, Robert Sward, who read from his new and selected poems, and Roy Mash. If you have any questions or comments, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And for all information on Word Temple, you can just go to wordtemple.com. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. Thanks for listening.